From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Terrell Spinall.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll find out how far one East Bay resident was willing to go to get a free house.
And that's when they finally were just like, enough's enough, you're going to jail.
Then we'll look at why free housing for some can mean financial ruin for others.
Carjacking is a criminal offense. But in Oakland, California, housejacking or squatting seems to be officially sanctioned.
And we'll see how one up-and-coming San Francisco neighborhood got its down-and-out name.
A lot of realtors and others who were invested in selling property in the area were really quite horrified. They thought that they'd never be able to sell a house in Dogpatch.
What it takes to turn a house into a home, today on Cross Currents. Like most cities in the Bay Area, Oakland's real estate prices have recently gone through the roof. The price of a house there has gone up around 70% in the last 2 years. But West Oakland resident Steve DiCaprio knows how to get a home for free. DiCaprio has become an expert in finding and taking over abandoned homes, and it's not as illegal as it might sound. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas paid a visit to DiCaprio's current home to find out how and why he does it.
Got some guard dogs.
Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I'm Steve.
I'm Jeremy.
Hi.
From the outside, Steve DiCaprio's house looks like a lot of homes you might see in West Oakland. It's stucco, split into two apartments, and has a chain-link fence in the front yard. His could maybe use a paint job.
This is still a work in progress.
DiCaprio is in his early 40s. By day, he has a part-time job at the California League of Conservation Voters. By night, he plays with a black metal band. But mostly, he spends a lot of time on his house.
This is
a bathroom and a bike room?
Yeah. There was a bathtub here. We took the bathtub out. Let's go upstairs. So, as you can see, all this plaster is just kind of falling off.
Part of the second floor doesn't have a ceiling. DiCaprio says the plumbing had to be replaced when a fire melted the sewer line, and the electricity and gas are off the grid.
And we actually redid all the electrical. It's all brand new, up to code, but
the city wouldn't issue permits, so they can't connect to power. Because the thing is, even though DiCaprio has basically built this house back up from scratch over the past 14 years, he doesn't technically own it. At least not on paper.
They said, oh, you're a bunch of squatters. We don't issue permits to squatters.
Squatting is when you live in a building that isn't yours without asking anyone. And that's exactly what DiCaprio and his housemates are doing. But he says the law is on his side. In California, in some cases, if you squat a building long enough, it's yours.
You occupy a property for 5 years, you pay the taxes.
That's property taxes.
And then you own it.
The legal name for it is adverse possession. And don't break out the crowbar just yet. There are actually a lot more rules than just that. Like, it has to be your sole residence. And
it has to be open, notorious, you know, not sneaking in, sneaking out.
It's a confusing legal gray area, but it's worth it to DiCaprio. For him, it's partially political. He says he doesn't like having to answer to banks and corporations.
And this is the beauty of squatting, is to stop acknowledging their authority.
And it's partially practical. He says he doesn't have a lot of money and he needs a place to live. And that's how he started his squatting odyssey. Back in 2000, after he'd been touring with his band in Europe and staying in squats there, he found himself back in the Bay without a home and decided to try it here. So here's how he got into his current house. Step one, he went on a hunt around the East Bay.
Block by block, finding houses that looked abandoned.
Houses with their windows boarded up, with the utilities completely off, or maybe a tree growing through the roof. Like this one did. DiCaprio says he found at least a dozen buildings like this. Step two, research.
Find out what the backstory is with each house.
He learned that the house had been empty for decades. So, step three, he tried to contact the person listed as the owner. That man had been dead since 1982.
And the whole idea is that once all of our research indicated that there was nobody interested in the property, then we would...
Step four.
Enter it. And this is the first house that I entered.
But just because you're in a house doesn't mean you're home free. DiCaprio has run into problems with the police before, at a different squat, in 2004, in South Berkeley. Here's what that sounded like.
I've read the text.
Okay, that's fine, Mr. DiCaprio. I know you've been cited for that in the past.
And under what?
That was a clip from a documentary film of DiCaprio tussling with a Berkeley police sergeant. The neighbors there knew he was a squatter, and they didn't like it. They said he was trespassing and kept calling the police on him. DiCaprio countered by saying,
in California and under most laws, you can't trespass on abandoned property. It's an oxymoron.
But the police kept kicking him out.
You know, they'd board it up, and then I'd come back with, like, a hammer, and then they'd, like, then they'd have countersunk screws, and then I'd come back with a crowbar and a Sawzall, and then they welded the storm door shut with an arc welder, and then I came back with a can of WD-40 and a Dremel with a diamond blade, and that's when they finally were just like, enough's enough, you're going to jail.
DiCaprio wouldn't give up. He hit the books, learned property law, and represented himself in court. Eventually, someone found an heir to the house's original owner, and DiCaprio was found guilty by a judge of trespassing. But even then, he continued squatting, and he continued studying.
So, yeah, there's a... Yeah, you know, I have a whole filing cabinet full of my own personal lawsuits.
There are documents all over his bedroom.
Probably the prudent thing would have been just to back away, but I was so angry.
Even though he lost his Berkeley house, he's still fighting for his current one. But the last time he went to court to get it transferred to his name, the judge was not convinced. He told DiCaprio to find an heir, and he may have found one, but he didn't want to give his house away.
Because no one that was even remotely related to the person who used to own this house even knows that this house exists. Who cares about this house? Nobody but me. Nobody cares about this house except for me.
And in a way, he's right. At least according to Leslie Cleaver Wood.
Squatting is absolutely not an issue okay. for us.
She's a member of a local neighborhood association.
I think, you know, we welcome anyone in a home that's been vacant as long as it's, again, safe and good neighbors.
Since DiCaprio started squatting, he's had to bone up on so much property law that he is on his way to passing the bar exam.
If and when I pass the bar, I would most likely be the only attorney that specializes in squatting.
And in the meantime, he's founded an organization called Land Action to help give the resources to other squatters to help them defend themselves, just like he did. DiCaprio says if he had it his way, there'd be millions of squatters all over the country. But sometimes DiCaprio made me think that for him, it almost isn't even about the building, that it's about the challenge.
I'll get this house completely... It'll be totally decked out. We'll have a hot tub in the backyard. Everything will be perfect, and I'll say, all right, let's move. Project's over. Let's leave the fruit on the vine.
Because there's always going to be another building to fix up and another judge to fight. In Oakland, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
The film clip in that story came from Hannah Dobbs' 2008 documentary, Shelter, a Squatchumentary. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. As we just heard, Steve DiCaprio found a way to move into abandoned homes, but squatters don't always limit themselves to houses without known owners. Just ask Opal Palmer Adisa. 3 years ago, two tenants took over her Oakland home, which she had rented to them during her academic year abroad. When she tried to move back in after the lease was up, they refused to get out or pay the rent. She shared the story with us in this commentary recorded back in 2011.
These people, the tenants, have told me that they have no intention of moving. They have told me they're going to purchase my house. This is apparently the latest scam. A group of people rent a property, pay for a while, then stop paying. Then they wait until the house goes into foreclosure. My house is heading in that direction. Then they turn around and purchase the property at below market value. Although I've tried to evict the tenants on my own since February, they are still in my home and I've been left homeless. I had a friend paste eviction notices all over the house so they couldn't claim ignorance. I've tried reasoning with them, tried to negotiate an agreement, but to no avail. Carjacking is a criminal offense. But in Oakland, California, housejacking or squatting seems to be officially sanctioned and quite legal.
That's Oakland homeowner Opal Palmer Adisa. She recorded that story for us back in 2011. Last week, we reached out to her for an update, which she shared with us via Skype.
As a result of the show, someone pro bono decided that they would help me to get them out. And so I was granted injunction, which meant I won the case and was entitled, or am entitled, to back rent for the 10 months that they were in the house. And they completely trashed the house. I mean, I was just so devastated because here were people who were in my house for 10 months, who had not paid PG&E, water, anything. I mean, it was really bad. And I was really, I felt disempowered and weak, and that there was really no justice.
By the time Adisa reclaimed her home, her mortgage was sold to a new bank and the place was in foreclosure. She says she did a short sale and Wells Fargo bought the home. But
I'm still in the house and I'm still fighting. I still get stuff from Wells Fargo that says I have to move out. Nobody seems to want to deal with me with regards to refinancing the house and maintaining it. You know, I'm at the end of my rope and I'm really tired, and I really think that if something doesn't happen this year, you know, I'll stay in the house until basically they evict me, you know, and I should have been out and I have nowhere else to go, and so I'm just there. So that really is the story. It's not a unique story, you know. I can't tell you how many people, there's still a group in L.A. That has started as a result of my efforts, and because that is still happening. It is still happening. You know, I am not for people being exploited, and I know that sometimes tenants are exploited, but there has to be equity.
Opal Palmer Adisa said this situation cost her about $20,000 and ruined her credit. And she said that after we first aired her story, about 50 people in similar situations contacted her. You can find links to some of the organizations that helped Adisa at our website. It's klw.org. That's also where you can hear more local stories and let us know what you think we should be covering. klw.org, and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Wherever you make your home, there's a story behind the name of the place you live. A lot of Bay Area place names come from two main sources. They're either named for Catholic saints,
San Mateo,
San Francisco,
San Bruno,
Santa Clara,
Santa Cruz,
or they're named after physical features of the area.
Potrero Hill,
Glen Park,
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
But there's one neighborhood here in San Francisco that seems to be named after a fictional location in a newspaper comic strip. KLW's Stephen Short doggedly tracked down this neighborhood and shares the story of how it got its name in this installment of The Source.
Only in San Francisco could 3rd and 22nd Streets intersect, right?
Manhattan famously has the intersection of 33rd and 3rd, but one of those is a street and the other is an avenue. So Christopher Plank might be right about this. He's an architectural historian and preservationist who has surveyed every home and business near 3rd and 22nd, east of Potrero Hill. He's been studying the neighborhood since 1997. Verplank says that section of town contains some of the oldest homes in San Francisco.
Because it, of course, escaped the fires after the 1906 earthquake. So there are a lot of really old Victorians, 1870s, 1880s.
Calling the neighborhood Old Victorian might have had some merit, but that nickname didn't come up when Verplank started his historic district project. Instead,
we called it the Dog Patch Survey.
That's what most people call the neighborhood these days, even over the objection of some interested parties, and even if they have no idea why.
A lot of realtors and others who were invested in selling property in the area were really quite horrified. They thought that they'd never be able to sell a house in Dogpatch.
In the prestigious Dogpatch community.
Exactly. Yeah, get in on the ground floor of urban homesteading. I've seen that before. That's well past its prime.
This neighborhood, like most in the Bay Area, has had previous names. The Ohlone Indians probably called the area something, but the Spanish settlers who arrived in the late 1770s didn't use it. For them...
initially it was just the Potrero Hill.
Potrero is Spanish for field or pasture. After the next wave of immigrants arrived a few decades later, Verplank says this part of the city, known then simply as the Central Waterfront, became highly industrialized.
I mean, this was the most important location of heavy industry in California in the 19th century. You know, so it was a very extraordinarily important place.
And while this meant plenty of jobs, it also meant housing was scarce for the influx of new workers. Some things just never change around here. When Verplank started his research about this part of town, he first went to old newspapers. They gave him some clues about its early names.
Well, when I looked into the old newspaper accounts, I saw several references to a place called Dutchman's Flat. And it's interesting because I'd never heard that from any of the old-timers.
This was confusing to Verplank because few, if any, Dutchmen ever lived there.
The first settlers of this area were mostly German. And, of course, there was, at that time, Dutchman and Deutsch was often confused.
So Deutsch, or Deutschmann, soon became Dutchman. According to Verplank, that name held even after the Irish from nearby rough-and-tumble Irish Hill started moving in. And then they were replaced by Italians, who remained dominant until the 1930s. By then, Verplank says, the names Dutchman's Flat and Lower Potrero may have both been in use, if the area was specifically identified at all. During the 1930s, the shipyards provided even more jobs as the nation prepared for World War II. And Verplank says that brought even more cultures.
You know, it attracts a lot of, actually my ancestors, the Dust Bowl Okies, who arrived in California to work in the fields.
They soon migrated from the fields to the factories, settling near their work. The first printed reference to the name Dogpatch showed up soon after, around 1940. But that story didn't cite the source, as if this was well established at the time. That caused Verplank to return to the neighborhood, and he started asking around.
And what I was told was that the name referred to a particular block of Tennessee Street, which was unpaved, it was a dead-end street, and it's where a lot of these Dust Bowl workers, lived.
Then why wasn't it called Dust Bowl? Why Dogpatch?
So my sense is that the origin of this name was from the comic strip, Little Abner. And, of course, the fictional town of Dogpatch, Arkansas, I believe it was basically where these, kind of hillbilly characters lived.
Little Abner! It's alive! And here they are, those wonderful people from Dogpatch, USA.
Little Abner was an extremely popular comic that ran daily in hundreds of newspapers for 43 years, from 1934 to 1977, both in this country and Europe. If you can't picture the residents of Dogpatch with their bare feet, patched overalls, and corncob pipes, just think of the Beverly Hillbillies TV series from the 1960s. All of the main characters were clearly inspired by the Little Abner comic.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
And remember the dates here. Little Abner started in 1934, and Verplank's first printed reference to Dogpatch was when?
The earliest reference I could see to it was about 1940.
Coincidence? I think not. Verplank has two theories as to why the Dogpatch name wasn't especially popular at the time. One,
I don't think that they necessarily stayed around very long. Dust Bowl refugees who worked in the shipyards eventually moved out of the city, moved out pretty quickly.
And his second theory about why the name didn't stick.
Because, of course, it denoted poverty.
One group that did stay around didn't use the name because it didn't apply to them.
It was a derogatory term for a poor white neighborhood. And by the 50s, it was mostly African American. And a lot of older black residents I talked to called the area simply Lower Potrero, the Potrero, or some people actually called it 22nd and 3rd, actually, is what they called it.
But Christopher Plank's research has managed to revive that old maligned dog patch name to such an extent that the neighborhood association and some businesses are happy to claim it again.
Once we actually did find some sort of provenance for it in the newspapers, that's when they decided to use it for the neighborhood association and their newsletter.
So now the name is back in the newspapers again, only this time you're more likely to see it in the real estate section than on the comics page. In San Francisco's Dog Patch neighborhood, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Do you know the story behind your neighborhood's name? Tell us by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. And now it's time for another installment of Segment X, extras from the KLW News Team. X. This is where our staff members pull back the curtain on radio production to share something extra, odd, interesting, or delightful with you. This week, Seth Samuel asked some questions and got these answers.
Can you tell me a bit about your dog?
Yes.
Did you bring a dog?
No.
Have you been to a dog show before?
Yes.
Have you ever bitten anybody?
No.
He's performing now? Is performing the right word?
No.
Are there characteristics of a Labrador that he's exemplary of?
Yeah.
A good dog for a pet?
Sure.
Does your house have kids?
Yeah.
Is speak, I know that's a kind of a classic dog trick, is speak not a trick done at dog shows?
No.
Does Paris know any tricks?
Nope.
Wow. They are really thrashing around.
Yeah.
I kind of thought that they were poodles.
Yeah.
Have they been at dog shows before?
Yeah.
And I guess we're here at the information desk at the Cow Palace?
Yes.
Have you done this before?
Yes.
They all compete against each other?
Yes.
Do you have a dog?
Yes.
I guess you like dogs.
Yes.
Is once she's a champion, is she a champion for the rest of her life?
Yes.
Do you ever call her the undisputed champion, or is that going a little too far?
No.
Okay, so now that she's a champion, does she ever need to compete again? Does she?
Yeah.
So you have 10 dachshunds?
Yes, we do.
That's pretty specific.
Yes, it is.
Do dogs get any bigger than this?
Yeah.
Can he bark on command?
No.
What are his chances?
Huh?
Have you sold many leashes today?
Yes and no.
And would you say that dog shows would be your main client base?
Yeah.
Do you go to other shows besides the one here at the Cow Palace?
Yeah.
Are you able to teach old dogs new tricks?
Yes.
Can he hear okay even with such small ears?
Yeah.
What's the last corn dog you had?
Probably when I was about 16 or 17, I'd say.
How was it?
They're not very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
No. Yes, we do.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Nope.
What?
Yeah.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
No.
No. Yes and no.
Huh?
You can find previous editions of Segment X and subscribe to our podcast at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Audrey Dilling, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Daphne Matsiaraki, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Charlotte Silver, Stephen Short, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was produced by Jen Chien and engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to your generosity, we can proudly say we are listener-supported, independent, local public radio. Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll visit a San Francisco job center to hear about the realities of being unemployed here.
Finding a long-term job
in this city is next to impossible. So, I mean, my options in the next 3 months, I'll probably have to move. And I've lived here my entire life.
Trying to Keep Afloat, that's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The sounds you're hearing now are by the experimental folk duo known as Yes Way. Their sound has been called a floating, flowing faucet of magical unification. That's a lot to ask from just two singers, but if you think you're up for the experience, they'll be on stage tomorrow at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco starting about 8 p.m. All of that information, along with more local music and more local stories, is at klw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.